Views, opinions, and content of the show. Bobby is on Instagram.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Outside the Studio. I'm your host, Matthew Blitner, and in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page Damari, you can visit her website, jdcompositions.com, for her full works. And now, for the next 59 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes, and boy, has it been a week in the National Hockey League. Along with having a full slate of games, in which the early season jitters for fans and teams are long gone, and teams are starting to show what they may or may not be this year, including some surprises like down in Florida, who had raced out to a 7-0 start. Unfortunately, there is also the negative side of things, and that is the Chicago Blackhawks scandal dating back to 2010. For those of you who have not been reading the news, watching the news, listening to the news, or paying attention at all to the Chicago Blackhawks last several months, we now know that the video coach for that famous, now infamous, Chicago Blackhawks Stanley Cup team, Brad Aldrich, was accused by a player first thought to be referenced as John Doe, who has now come forward. His name is Kyle Beach. He was one of the Black Aces, as one of the players who traveled and practiced with the team during the playoffs, although he did not get into any of the games. And Aldrich is accused by Beach of sexually assaulting him at some point during the end of the regular season, maybe possibly into the beginning of the playoffs. And Jenner and Block Law Firm came out with the well over 100-page report on, I believe it was Tuesday afternoon, stating that the Blackhawks not only knew about this situation, but they also essentially covered it up. There was a meeting held amongst the team's brain trust, excluding the ownership, so the Wirtz family was not involved with the meeting, shortly after they clinched a spot in the Stanley Cup Final, in which Al McIsaac, the Senior Director of Hockey Operations, John McDonough, the Team President, Stan Bowman, the General Manager, Jay Blunk, the Executive Vice President, Kevin Cheveldayoff, the Assistant General Manager, Joel Quenneville, the Head Coach, and James Gary, the Mental Skills Coach, all met together to discuss the allegations brought forth by one of the coaches in Paul Vincent, who had been made aware of the allegations against Aldrich. And as a former police officer, Paul Vincent suggested and basically said that the team should go to the authorities. The team needed to go to the authorities. He did what he was supposed to do. He reported the situation to his superiors, and it was now in their hands to do the right thing. Unfortunately, the Chicago Blackhawks did not do the right thing. They let down Kyle Beach. They let down their fan base. They let down their organization. And they let everybody down, except Aldrich, who basically skated scot-free. Al McIsaac has been let go from the team. John McDonough was fired last offseason for issues not related to this scandal. Stan Bowman resigned in disgrace, although many argue that he should not have been given the opportunity to resign. Many say that he should have been fired. However, the Blackhawks did allow him to resign. He also was allowed to resign from the Olympics in terms of being general manager there. Jay Blunt is gone. Kevin Sheveldayoff is the general manager for the last several years of the Winnipeg Jets. He met with the commissioner, Gary Bettman, today. And while many were expecting him to either resign or be let go by the Jets or be suspended at the very least by the National Hockey League, none of that happened. Around, I want to say it was 12:30 Eastern time, we were given the report that Gary Bettman in the National Hockey League feel that Sheveldayoff, as the assistant general manager for the Blackhawks at the time of this incident, was merely just a person sitting in the room amongst his superiors and basically gets off scot-free for the fact that, well, you know, his superiors were in the room and it was up to them to make a decision, even though he didn't stand up and he didn't do anything to help the situation. So many in the court of public opinion have rightfully said that Sheveldayoff is just as culpable, just as guilty as Joel Quenneville and Stan Bowman and the rest. They would be right. But for whatever reason, the Winnipeg Jets and the National Hockey League have felt that he gets off without so much as a slap on the wrist. It's an absolute shame the National Hockey League and the Chicago Blackhawks over the last couple of days have gone out of their way to talk about and put out press releases and put out statements saying, you know, see something, say something, you have to report this, do that. We need to make changes, we need to be better. Well, they had their opportunity, and they failed. They had their opportunity the other night with Joel Quenneville to prevent him from coaching Wednesday night for the Panthers. They had the opportunity to say, after Kyle Beach's interview went viral on ESPN and TSN, in which he was on SportsCenter and bore his soul for 22 minutes. He had everybody watching that absolutely in tears and in disgust. And here was a young man who, he's now 31 at the time, he was in his early 20s at the time of the incident. He felt sorry for not being able to do more to prevent the future victims that Aldridge sexually assaulted when he went on to other jobs that the Blackhawks recommended him for. Listen up closely, people. The kid who was abused felt sorry for not being able to do more. That shows the courage and the heart that this kid has to be able to say that he wishes he could have done more. Yet the people he went to, the people that he entrusted his safety to, the people that he put his faith in, couldn't be bothered to stand up and do anything, all because the Chicago Blackhawks were on their way to Stanley Cup Final, and they didn't want to disrupt any team chemistry. They didn't want to disrupt anything going on with the team. They didn't want it to become a distraction. Listen up. They protected the damn video coach. They could have had an intern do his job at the same quality and just quietly let him go without even having to make a statement. Okay, they didn't even have to come out and say, this is why we're letting him go. Just, there's been a difference of opinion, and he is no longer employed by the team. They didn't even do that. They didn't even report the incident to human resources until weeks later. They didn't report it to the police at all. They didn't do anything to help this young man. They let themselves down, and Quenneville, who was one of the main people in saying he was reported in the meeting as being agitated and is saying, you know, we can't deal with this right now because you never know when you're going to get back to the Stanley Cup Final. He was allowed to coach the Florida Panthers on Wednesday night after this report came out. I've got news for you. That was absolutely the wrong call. He should have had the decency to resign, which he later... You can say whether he was forced to resign, there's different speculations. The official word is he resigned on Thursday. He could have very easily said, you know what, I do not want to be a distraction to the team right now, and I will not coach tonight. The Florida Panthers should have said, you're not coaching tonight. The National Hockey League should have said, you're not coaching tonight, pending the outcome of this investigation and your meeting with Gary Bettman on Thursday. None of them did what was right. And today, again, Kevin Sheveldayoff, while he has not resigned, many people are still calling for his head. And you can argue that if Quenneville, who, by the way, was the head coach, was punished for something that happened 11 years later. And Gary Bettman is saying that the assistant general manager wasn't high enough on the hierarchy to be held accountable. The head coach was held accountable. Well, last I checked, the assistant coach is higher on the totem pole than the head coach. He's higher on the totem pole than the mental skills coach. The National Hockey League has been preaching accountability. They failed and failed and failed again. This is not something that they is a one-time mistake. They continue to do this. And if you want to look in Kevin Cheveldayoff's closet, last I checked, he failed at Hema Lou back in 2009 with the racist incident as well that rocked the sport roughly 10 years after the fact. So you're telling me that a man who not once has failed in his mission to be held accountable and to be a leader, he's now failed twice and he's dying away with it. Look, I don't have an axe to grind. I have absolutely nothing against Cheveldayoff as a general manager in the National Hockey League in terms of the moves that he's made to build the Winnipeg Jets. But there's no denying that if he's failed repeatedly in this situation to stand up and be the leader that he needs to be, then he needs to go. Plain and simple. There's no two ways around it. And if you want to talk about, well, you know, maybe the players should have stepped up, I've got news for you. You don't want the Chicago Blackhawks players stepping up and saying anything, not after that atrocity Wednesday night. Not in which Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews did worse than putting their foots in their mouths in praising McIsaac and Bowman and Quenneville and McDonough. They really went out of their way to praise. They said, you know, we wish we could have done different. We didn't know about it until after the fact. First of all, that's bull. The facts of the matter are that they knew. They were part of the players who were harassing Beach in the following training camp. And they went out of their way to praise the executives who did the cover-up. So clearly, fans were eager. Fans were dying to hear from their captain, Jonathan Toews, and from their star, Patrick Kane. They made it worse. They really should have just put out a two-sentence press release. That would have been better than what they did. And it just goes to show you that the National Hockey League and its teams and its players have a long, long way to go before they can really claim to hold people accountable and before they can really say that they're making a change. Because as of right now, they're not doing that. And no $2 million fine from the National Hockey League for their actions and saying that, well, we're going to give half the money, so $1 million, to organizations around Chicago who help sexual abuse victims. That's not going to cut it. And last I checked, and people have brought this up, the National Hockey League fined the New Jersey Devils $3 million when they circumvented Ilya Kovalchuk's salary cap situation in roughly 8 years ago. Do you mean to tell me that circumventing the salary cap gets you fined $3 million, but covering up a sexual assault gets you fined $2 million? Where does that make sense? It's like the Department of Player Safety all over again from last year, in which Artemi Panarin and Pavel Buchnevich were the victims essentially of assault at the hands of Tom Wilson. And Tom Wilson got by with no suspension, just a minor fine. What are they doing? You want to preach accountability? Start acting like you actually care. Start acting like you need to make a change, that you want to make a change. The Players Association failed in this situation, but no one's talking about that really, other than Farrah putting out a brief couple paragraph statement saying that he apologizes, and he barely apologized at that in the statement. This is a dark time for the National Hockey League in regards to this, and it should be surprising. It should be something that we're saying, we can't believe the National Hockey League is not handling this properly. We can't believe that the Chicago Blackhawks aren't handling this properly. You know what? It's no longer a surprise. With how much they have routinely failed over and over and over again, it does not... I would not blame Kyle Beach, Akeem Alou, any player in the National Hockey League for not having faith in their superiors at this point of time. I hope that the National Hockey League and its member clubs are able to do something very, very soon to make the situation better, to go about and actually make a change. Because hockey culture, this is going to drive fans away who are the lifeblood of the sport. It's going to drive players away from wanting to play. It's going to drive everybody away, and they're going to be held, and they're going to be left standing when the music stops with absolutely nowhere to go. It's an absolute disgrace, and we're calling on the National Hockey League to make significant changes. So we highly hope that everyone can go out and continue to support Kyle Beach in his quest to get justice. And we hope that we are not sitting here months from now having to talk about this again. In the meantime, though, we will continue with our hockey discussion, as difficult as it will be, and we want to try to bring some positivity to today's show. Not to skate over anything, but there's only so much that we can do by saying things on the air. People behind the scenes are the ones who need to make change. So we're going to be joined in a brief moment by NHL legend Bernie Nichols, who played for the Devils, played for the Rangers, played for the Kings, played for a number of clubs during his time in the National Hockey League. And we're going to be joined by him in just a moment. And bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, Bernie Nichols, his career is an astounding one. He played 1,127 games, scoring 1,209 points. He did this throughout the 80s and 90s. And like I said, we're going to be joined by Bernie Nichols right now as we connect him in to outside the studio. And we're going to be pleased to talk with him about his career and what he sees in the hockey league today. Hi, Bernie. It's Matthew with Outside the Studio. How are you today?
Good, bud. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us here. And, you know, you're one of the best goal scorers of your generation, which is saying something, because if you think about it, you played at the same time as Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Mario Lemieux. You played at the same time as a lot of these guys, and yet you're still one of the greats. Unfortunately, you're not in the Hockey Hall of Fame, and we'd like to know why, because it's mind-boggling.
Well, maybe because I played in the West Coast for the majority of my career, and as we all know, people in the East Coast don't stay up late enough to watch the players play in the West Coast, so that might have been part of it.
But, Bernie, come on. And it's not the fans who vote for you. It's the writers, and it's the writers' jobs to stay up. And you mean to tell me, you know,
yeah,
Gretzky played on the West Coast, whether the Western Canada or West Coast of the United States, for most of his career? Come on.
Yeah, I think if I'd have played in Toronto or Montreal, I would have been inducted the next day when I retired. But I think, I don't know, you look at some guys that are in there, my stats are the same, if not better, but they're in there. And, you know, they were probably Leafs players or players from Montreal, so a Canadian team. So I don't know. I would like to ask certain people that do pick, if you pick this guy, how can this guy not be in? You know, and just see what they say. So, I don't know.
Well, we hope that that injustice is righted very soon. Of course, you spent most of the bulk of your career with the Los Angeles Kings, and for a good portion of that time, you played on the famous Triple Crown line. So, talk to us a little bit. What was it like playing on one of the most iconic lines in hockey history?
Well, I actually didn't play on it. Marcel did. Marcel, Dion, Charlie Simmer, and Dave Taylor. They were fun to watch, I know that. And for me, I got to play with them on the power play sometimes when they put Marcel on defense. So I did get to play with them. Perfect people to play with. Two big, strong boys. They did all the dirty work and got me the puck, and I put it in the net. So it was fun playing with them.
And, you know, in terms of putting the puck in the net, obviously, you know, there were very, very few, if any, who did better than you in that. And there's a game that I want to turn your attention to, and it's been dubbed the Miracle on Manchester. You guys played that game against the Oilers, who, let's be honest, the Oilers were the favorites. Everyone knows the Oilers were the favorites. And you guys absolutely came back and stunned them. You stunned them worse than a boxer who throws a right hook out of nowhere and drops his opponent. So what do you recall from that game, knowing that once you guys started coming back and just to see the Oilers fold like that, what are your recollections of that?
Well, it's the old saying, when you get momentum going on your side, and, you know, we absolutely had no business beating them in that series. They were by far the better team. I think after that, they went on to win, I think, four of the next 5 years Stanley Cup. But 5-0 going in the third period. It's late in the, well, it's the middle of the third. There's 12 minutes to go in the third period, and Gary Unger takes a 5-minute high-sticking penalty. So that kind of turned it around. We scored two goals on that, but we're still down 5-2. And then I think with, might have been 3 minutes to go, something like that, we scored to make it 5-3. But I think the momentum just turned, and we got the momentum going, and when you get it going in your favor, it's tough to stop it. We pulled our goalie, and we scored with about a little over a minute, and then we pulled them again, and we scored probably under 20 seconds. So that got us tied. Still should never have won the game, but in overtime, face-off in their end. Doug Smith wins the face-off, and Darrell Evans scores. So best comeback probably in hockey. And so to be a part of that, that was pretty cool.
What was the players' reactions on the bench? Because that's not something that you see every day, you know. Oh, even when you play when you're the best team in the world and you play the worst team in the world, you don't see 5-0 comebacks. You know, it's not baseball where you come back from 5 runs. It's not football where you can come back from a couple of scores, or basketball, come back from, you know, 20-point deficits. Hockey, you know, a 5-goal deficit in the third period is pretty much a death knell 99 times out of 100. So, you know, what was the reaction on the bench?
Yeah, and there's only 12 minutes to go in the third period. The funny thing was, back then, our owner, his box was right beside our bench. And when we came out for the third, he was gone home, which was kind of funny for the comeback. Then he was probably listening to it on the radio, and then he felt like an ass. No, it's like anything. And one thing about professional athletes is, for the most part, they don't give up. And there's always a chance until the end of the buzzer or the end of the whistle, whatever. And we just got it going and never quit, kept going, and made it happen. So it was fun for everybody on our side anyways. And, you know, then go on to beat them in 5 games, so
and look, cool. Look, Bernie, that was obviously a very just an incredible game to be a part of, especially on the winning side of it. I want to flip the script a little bit right now. We're going to fast forward a number of years. You were on the Devils in 1994 when the Devils and Rangers met in what many call the greatest playoff series in NHL history, in the Eastern Conference Final. Obviously, we all know what happened. Looking back, the Devils had a 2-0 lead in Game 6 in the second period. Messier goes on to have a hat trick. Kovalev has a goal. Game 7, Stefan Matto, double overtime. And the Rangers go on to win the Cup against Vancouver. But during Game 6, during the second intermission, there's a rumor. Now, I wasn't there, so, you know, I'm not saying whether I think the rumor is true or not. But there's a rumor that you gave an interview with the Devils broadcast crew, and without saying the words, you pretty much admitted that the Rangers had you guys. Care to clear up that situation for us?
Oh, yeah, that never happened. I never gave an interview saying that, nor would I say that. we felt we had the best team. And if, and I still feel this day, if we had of, if we'd have went into the third period down up 2-0, I don't think they could have beat us. We had a rookie mistake late in the second period. Billy Guerin turned the puck over at center ice when we were making a change, and they go down 3-on-1, and Kovalev scores that goal. And then obviously game 7. But I tell people this day that was the most fun, the best series I was ever involved in, even though we end up losing it. It was as good as it gets. Two good teams. You know, we still feel we were the better team, but we didn't win, and that happens. Rangers go on to win the Cup. But as you mentioned earlier, and I'm sure not just because of the New York fans and in New York, but, yeah, I don't think there'd be a series that would ever be better than that. Three games went into overtime. Last game goes into double overtime. So I think, you know, I think that the two worst goals Marty gave up that whole year and maybe his whole career was Messier's first goal in the third period, a weak backhand, and the wraparound goal on Mateau in overtime. And, you know, Marty saves those things 99 out of 100 times, every one of them. And he was by far the best player in the whole series, the whole playoffs that year. So it was too bad, but, and that was his first year. He was unbelievable.
He really was.
So it was a great series.
Yeah, and we certainly appreciate you clearing up that rumor. Like I said, you know, wasn't saying, you know, wasn't accusing anything, just, you know, it, you know, a rumor, and rumors sometimes need to be addressed. One thing that was probably, maybe not as...
You know what, even though what you said, no one would ever say that in an interview during the playoffs, or during any time, I don't think. I don't think there's an athlete in the world that would say that during a playoff game.
I hope not, otherwise they shouldn't be playing in it. But
well, yeah. No, I don't know.
Yeah, something that should be, I don't know, as fun of a series, but when you were with the Kings, so we're going to backtrack just a second, you did get a chance to come play in New York, well, practice in New York at the famous Lasker Rink in Central Park. And while it's not a game, obviously, and it's not a playoff series, so you don't have that adrenaline going the same way. You don't have 19,000 plus fans either booing or cheering, depending on who they're rooting for. But what was that experience like to, you know, get to play outdoors, you know, to practice outdoors in a world famous rink? You know, nowadays, obviously, the National Hockey League does this, you know, pretty much every year. They have the Winter Classic, they have the Heritage Classic, they have the Stadium Series. But back then, they didn't really have stuff like this.
No. You know, growing up in Canada, playing outdoors my whole life, and that's why I think these outdoor games are so, the kids love playing them so much, because that's basically how they grew up, especially the Canadian boys. We grew up skating on ponds, shoveling them off, frozen rinks outside. That's how we grew up, so that was fun. New York was fun. I think the first game that was ever played outdoors was New York and L.A. at Caesar's Palace.
Yes, I believe that was early 1990s.
Yeah. So that was spectacular. I think that was the first one that ever happened, and now they've seen how good that was, and now they play it everywhere. So... No, that was a lot of fun playing there, too.
Yes, and, sure. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, by the way, we're talking with NHL legend Bernie Nichols. Bernie, before we let you go, I need to ask, because, you know, it's a question that a lot of people have for former star athletes in all sports. If a National Hockey League team came up to you tomorrow and said, listen, we're going to give you $2 million plus, you know, we're going to give you bonuses for, you know, X different stats that you can reach, you know, easily attainable type of things. And we promise you're not going to get, you know, checked the way like an Eric Lindros would check someone. You know, you're pretty much going to go untouched outside of the occasional, you know, elbow to the rib cage or something. Would you consider suiting back up?
Oh, 100%. And they could hit me, too, if they wanted to.
Really?
I'd have no problem with that. Oh, absolutely. I'd just stay out of the way of that anyways. But, I mean, the contact never bothered me, even though it might hurt a little more now. 30 years later. So, but yeah, I would have no problem suiting up. You wouldn't have to give me $2 million either.
Really? So along the hypothetical here, if you were to suit up, I mean, no one's expecting you to score 60 goals. You know, no one scores 60 goals in the National Hockey League anymore. But what type of offensive output would we be looking at? Because there are teams listening to this, and I'm sure they're probably thinking, well, you know, if he can guarantee X number of goals or points, you know, we'd love to have him.
Well, I think, you know, scoring, in one way, the scoring, you got more opportunities with power plays and this and that now. But for me... It's a little different now. Kids are so big and strong and fast. It would be, I'd be so out of place now. But I mean, the difference in hockey today that it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, kids are just bigger and stronger and faster. But they're not more skilled than in our era. You know, you can't teach hockey sense. And no one had it better than we did. So I think we could still play in today's game 20 years ago, if that makes sense.
It does. And, you know, it.
Yeah.
I'd like to see someone put that to, you know, put that to the test. Of course, in a controlled, you know, situation. We don't want anyone taking unnecessary risks. Bernie, we thank you so much for joining us here today. We could literally talk with you for hours, I'm sure. Unfortunately, our show does not run for hours. So we thank you so much for joining us. We hope you and your family are doing well, and we hope that you get to enjoy a lot of hockey now and, you know, going forward.
Okay, bud. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was NHL legend Bernie Nichols, and That was a very insightful interview. You know, I most certainly did not expect him to say that he'd be willing to suit up and for less than the $2 million as well, and that they could hit him. That's surprising. And, you know, so that was a great time talking to him. You know, Bernie's a very good personality to have around the game of hockey. Right now, we want to shift that focus from hockey for a minute, and. As always, we have to go to our weekly Pick'em segment, and even though our usual co-host, Dan Green, is not here, we do have his picks for this week. So first, I'm going to run through the games, and then I'm going to let you all know what picks we have in place. So, we have Bengals at Jets, Titans at Colts, Rams at Texans, Steelers at Browns, Eagles at Lions, 49ers at Bears, Panthers at Falcons, Dolphins at Bills, Patriots at Chargers, Jaguars at Seahawks, Washington at Broncos, Buccaneers at Saints, Cowboys at Vikings, and Giants at Chiefs. That's a really, really interesting Week 8 lineup in the National Football League, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to get you Dan's picks in just a second. So, Dan's 3-point pick. He's going with the Rams on the road against the Texans. Matthew Stafford has been having an unbelievable year at quarterback, proving that he wasn't the problem in Detroit. He really wasn't. The Rams are looking more offensive, more explosive than they ever have, than they ever did under Jared Goff. And who knew that Cooper Kupp could be, I mean, we all knew he was dynamic. Okay, that's first and foremost. But who knew that Cooper Kupp would be on the hot streak of his life this season. He's got almost 1,000 yards receiving, and he's got almost double-digit touchdowns already. We're in week 8. We're in week 8. There's still 10 weeks to go. The fact that the Rams are doing this, it's just incredible. So now, for Dan's two-point pick, he has a get-right game. And what do I mean by that? I mean the Chiefs have a chance on Monday night to do something against the Giants and to just obliterate the New York Giants and hopefully get things right for themselves as they try desperately to climb back into the playoff picture in the AFC. They have underachieved so far. There's been a lot of issues. Patrick Mahomes' footwork has been horrendous, which really isn't new, but it was masked by the Chiefs having such a great offense the last few years. He has to adjust. He hasn't done so yet. The opposition to the Chiefs have teed in on this. He's thrown more interceptions than he ever has. The Chiefs' defense is letting up more than 400 yards per game, which, if you look at it, I believe there's maybe been one team in NFL history to ever make it to the playoffs after allowing 400-plus yards average through an entire season. The Chiefs certainly have the offense to make up for it, but oof, boy, that defense is not good. And Dan's one-point pick, the surprise of the AFC this year, the Bengals, on the road, really shouldn't be a surprise because they're playing the Jets. And I know the Jets are at home, but Zach Wilson is on the IR. I believe he's been formally placed on the IR. If he hasn't, they will be doing so soon. They have White as their backup quarterback, who will be making his first ever NFL start. He's been cut by 5 teams previously. Zach Wilson's obviously out with a knee injury 2 to 4 weeks. This would only be the first week of that. It doesn't bode well if you're a Jets fan. And I know the Bengals are not a team that scares a lot of people. Obviously, they have got Jamar Chase. They've got Joe Burrow. This is the Bengals. I don't know whether it's that they're getting through this by having a weak schedule or whether they are legitimately as good as their record says they are. All I do know is that the Jets are not going to be the team to stand in their way. Not this week. Maybe if Zach Wilson was healthy and he had a healthy defense and a healthy offense and O-line and wide receiver corps and running back group, maybe they might make a game of it until falling apart late. That's not going to happen. I know the Jets own a victory over the Titans. I don't know how that happened. I really don't. Derrick Henry by himself has had games where he's put up more total yards than the Jets have this year. And I know that that's not actually a case, but it seems like it. So it's abominable what the Jets are doing. So that's Dan's 3 picks. He has the Rams for 3, the Chiefs for 2, and the Bengals for 1. I myself, who by the way, I still hold a 2-point lead, 29-27 for the season over Dan. I'm 14 for 18 where he's 13 for 18. 2 weeks ago was not kind to me, but last week went 3 for 3. Unfortunately, so did Dan. So this week, it's up to me to make sure that I can go ahead and make sure that he does not catch me. I have absolutely no desire to wear whatever ridiculous getup he's going to have me that he would want me to dress in order to go outside in public as per the terms of that bet for the loser. So my 3-point pick. Not exactly a surprise. I'm riding the Buffalo Bills over the Dolphins. The Bills are the class of the AFC this year. The Bills, Josh Allen, has proved that if people thought last year was a fluke, well, it really isn't because he's just been terrific this year. There's absolutely no reason for the Bills to not win the AFC East. There's no reason for them not to get to the AFC Championship game. And quite honestly, there's no reason for them to not get back to the Super Bowl unless the Chiefs somehow turn things around or unless the Titans somehow get a lot better. So the Bills are my 3-point pick, and I think it's a fairly safe one. Now, last week, obviously, I went with the Cardinals, Bucks, and Saints, so I can't pick any of those 3 teams. Obviously, the Cardinals lost last night, so they are ineligible for our picks anyway. And the Bucks and Saints are playing each other this week, go figure. So I am going to go with a game that really, it's a division battle. And a lot of people are saying, well, it can probably go either way. When in doubt, go with the home team. I'm going to say that the Atlanta Falcons at home are going to beat the free-falling Carolina Panthers. The Falcons, Matt Ryan at quarterback, Kyle Pitts at tight end. That's all they're going to need to get past Sam Darnold, who has just, him and the Panthers have imploded. After their 3-0 start, they've imploded, and that's the nicest way to put it. And my one-point pick, I'm going to go with a standby of mine. I'm going to say that the Titans take down the Colts. Derrick Henry is going to have a monster game, as he has been doing basically every week. So I'm going Bills 3, Falcons 2, Titans 1. And ladies and gentlemen, we will check back in with you next week in regards to where we stand in this. Dan took the safe, easy route. I'm taking a bit the more interesting route for this week in regards to how we're getting our picks. And as always, we will continue to do so each and every week. Right now, we're going to be joined by yet another excellent hockey guest. And he is a longtime NHL coach. He's a longtime, he was an NHL player. He was, he's an NHL analyst. And the name Bruce Boudreau is going to be joining us in just a minute. Bruce is going to talk about a lot of things, give us the coaching insight into a lot of things in the National Hockey League. And we look forward to chatting with him. He's one of the most respected coaches of his era. He's compiled in 984 NHL games behind the bench. He has 567 victories between the Capitals, the Ducks, and the Minnesota Wild. So we are being joined now as we connect Bruce into the show. And we, of course, want to thank him for joining us here today on this lovely Friday afternoon. Bruce, it's Matthew with Outside the Studio. How are you today?
I'm good, Matthew. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Now, to get into this, before we get into your coaching acumen, at one point in time, you were a prolific minor league and juniors scorer. You were getting a lot of points, a lot of goals, a lot of assists. I've got to ask, is the transition to the National Hockey League really that difficult that part of your game didn't follow you up?
I mean, from an honest answer, no, I don't think so at all. I mean, when I got a chance to play regularly up there, I mean, I scored. I mean, the two times I was up there, I think the first time I played 40 games and had 29 points. And then the next time I played 39 games and had 30 points. Like, I mean, so, but those were the only times I'd played regular up in the NHL. Everything else, it was fourth line. But I mean, one scout told me, he said, you know, the problem with you in the NHL is you're too small back in the day and you weren't fast enough. And he says, that's a bad combination. So,
someone should tell that scout that Marty St. Louis was told he's too small and fast enough, and look at what he did.
Like, forever I'll go down thinking I just never got an opportunity, but I think a lot of players will say the same thing, and when they don't do what they think they can do, because at every other level I scored as much as anybody. So I mean, but you know, that's what happens. The NHL is a different level when you play at with the best players in the world. Sometimes you're not as good as you think you are.
Well, I'm sure the truth lies somewhere in the middle. You know, maybe you weren't quite the scorer that you were in juniors, but maybe you were, you know, if you would have gotten the consistent top minutes in the NHL, maybe you would have been close to a point per game die. It's one of those big what ifs. But once you transitioned to coaching, you know, why did you choose to become a coach? I mean, look, let's be honest, the players, if you perform well, there's all the glitz, glamour, and fame in playing. But, you know, coaches, no one really seems to praise coaches. If they do well, it's because the players did well. And if they did badly, well, they get the blame unfairly. So, you know, why choose to go into that?
Well, quite frankly, if you knew me and the people that do know me, that know that that's all I ever thought about was hockey. And it was a 24-hour-a-day thing, and I was a pretty good student of the game. And once I thought that I wasn't going to be able to be a full-time NHL player, I wanted to stay in the game. And so coaching was the next aspect for me. I mean, I took, I think I was very good at taking what other coaches gave me and taking the best parts out of their games and sort of remembering it. I mean, I was sort of a statistical freak, that I would know all the stats of everybody. So it was just hockey was 24/7. So it seemed like trying to get into coaching when you were going to be done playing was a natural movement for me.
Well, it's evident through your voice that the passion for hockey has always and will always be there. You mentioned how, you know, you retained a lot from all your various coaches. What were some of those things that you retained and from who that really helped shape who you were as a head coach in the National Hockey League?
Well, I mean, it goes back as far as Junior B when I was playing. My coach was Bill White, and the details, the little details of the game that he taught you were amazing. George Armstrong in Junior A, he was probably the first player's coach, and I thought that I would have gone through a wall for him just because he was a great person. Roger Nielsen statistically was incredible, and would do, you know, again, retaining a lot of what he had to say. Andy Murray was very detailed in the same way. I mean, all of these guys, the way they treated you, when you had some coaches that treated you rather harshly and some coaches that treated you really well, you sort of got to know which way I reacted better. And so I wanted to be like that when I was a coach.
Well, you definitely were a very successful coach. And, you know, you started your National Hockey League head coaching and career with the Alexander Ovechkin-led Washington Capitals. Of course, you know, a lot of people have always said, you know, it's, I don't want to say that it's easier when you have a star player, you know, of such caliber that Ovechkin is, but it can't hurt, I would have to imagine. It certainly can't hurt having a prolific goal scorer like him. So what was it like coaching this generation, arguably one of the best goal scorers of National Hockey League history?
You know what? It wasn't hard. I mean, Alex is a great guy. I mean, every superstar, in the end, it's like a Hollywood actor, movie star, that, you know, they wanted to be, they want to get treated a little bit differently, and they do, and they deserve it. But Alex was a guy I could talk to. We got along very well. I knew his mistakes, and I didn't really harp on him because the good stuff was so much better than the bad stuff. I mean, I would tell him and show him that, you know, like, I mean, his back checking wasn't very good and his defensive work wasn't very good. But when you're the 1 year he was scoring 65 goals and winning the MVP, it's pretty hard to tell him too many other things. Altogether, I would say that, you know, if me and Alex got along very well.
Well, it's always great to hear, you know, when a coach and a player have a good bond. You know, you never want to hear that a coach and a player didn't get along, because then that just opens up a whole other can of worms. But mm-hmm. I have to ask, with the star power and all the great players that the Capitals had, you know, obviously Backstrom was there too, you know, why didn't the Capitals, you know, what if you could pinpoint, looking back now, and obviously hindsight's 20/20, what was that one, for lack of a better word, fatal flaw that for the reason why the Capitals weren't able to, you know, get over that hump?
Well, we were really young. You know, every player was young. I don't know if they really, you know, they always thought that there was going to be, we'll win it. It was sort of a lackadaisical thing. And, after I left them, it took them another 5 years to really understand what it was like to win. And you have to go through the losing to become good winners. I mean, Tampa did the same thing. I mean, they have had a great team for many years, but it took them 3 or 4 years as that team to understand what it was like to want to win. And now that they've got it, I mean, they're not going to lose it anytime soon. But the Caps were the same way, and it was the young Penguins were the same way. I mean, and the fact that even with the Caps, every time we lost was a 7-game 7. So, I mean, it wasn't like we just didn't show up. It was in my tenure, we lost 3 times in Game 7 to the eventual Stanley Cup winners. So who's to say if we didn't win that game, we wouldn't have won 3 cups ourselves. So, you know, it's tough, but I mean, that's the way of the world, I guess.
Well, thank you for that honesty in it, of course. Now, you mentioned, of course, that the Capitals were a young team. And here in New York right now, we have another young team in the Rangers who are trying to find their way. Probably not as gelled of a team as your Capitals were. You know, they're probably a bit out of step behind that in terms of their development at this particular moment. But we saw for the last couple of years, David Quinn wanted the Rangers to play north-south, straight edge, you know, gritty, you know, win the puck battles. And look, what coach doesn't want his team to play that way? Let's be fair. But for whatever reason, he couldn't get the players to completely buy into that. Gerard Gallant, who is now coaching the Rangers, is preaching the same thing. So, yes, the Rangers have gotten a couple more gritty dives, but the top six pretty much is unchanged. So, what does Gallant need to do in your eyes to get those same top six dives, like Zibanejad, like Panarin, like Strom, to buy into something that they didn't want to buy into the last few years in order to really help take this team to the next level?
Well, that's what coaching is all about, quite frankly. And to make it simplified, I mean, all coaches pretty well want everybody to be a 200-foot player. They all want the same things. We might differ in a little bit in the systems, but it's pretty well everybody's, you know, pretty well the same. But the difference becomes you got 23 players on the team. It's my job or the coach's job to find the 23 Achilles heels on these guys and be able to push that button that makes them play the best or makes them play the way you want to. And some guys can push those buttons. Some guys can never find out what those buttons are. And some guys push them all the time. And the guys that are able to push them all the time are the ones that are, for the most part, successful. They may not win the cup, but they're going to be successful.
Well, in terms of pushing buttons, I'd have to say that the Rangers' counterpart over at the Islanders, Barry Trotz, he's certainly been successful enough where he's probably pushing all the right buttons 9 times out of 10. You know, obviously the Islanders can have a clunker every now and again.
Barry had to learn too. And I love Barry, but I mean, his first 10 years in the NHL, they weren't in the playoffs, or he didn't make the playoffs, or if he did, he never won a round. But he learned too to how to push the right buttons. He always had the good systems, but I mean, it takes time. Experience is a very valuable thing as a coach in the NHL.
And I couldn't have put it any better. And it really is refreshing to hear Coach talk about how, you know, the experience is important. You know, it's not just, you know, okay, here's your players, go ahead and go. Maybe a coach might now and again get lucky with, you know, just that right situation first year, but that's probably rare. Mm-hmm. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with former NHL head coach Bruce Boudreau. Bruce, before we let you go, you're not currently a head coach in the National Hockey League. For what reason, I don't know. Do you have a desire to become a head coach again?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do. And I want to do it. So, I mean, I'm hoping that I get one more chance at it.
Well, I certainly hope that you get that one more chance. I'm sure a lot of people would love to see you come in and steer their team and go all the way. Your record speaks for itself, and, you know, in terms of almost 600 victories, that's nothing to sneeze at. So we thank you so much for joining us here today, Bruce. We wish you the best in all your current endeavors. We hope that you get to coach again. And we thank you for spending some of your time on this Friday afternoon with us here on Outside the Studio.
No problem. Just sorry it couldn't be longer, but thanks for having me on.
No worries. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was former NHL head coach Bruce Boudreau, who really, you know, he spoke very honestly. And, you know, a lot of times you're not going to get a coach to speak too honestly. It's one of those things that's called coach speak. They're not going to they're not going to give you what you're looking for. But I have to say, Bruce pretty much gave us what we were looking for. And, you know, I have to say thanks for that. Now, one thing, we're going to pivot here. We don't have a fan caller this week. We want to get to something that is similar to what we were just talking about. And that is the fact that over in Major League Baseball for the Yankees and the Mets, their off seasons aren't going so hot right now. We'll start with the Mets because there was more news about that earlier today. They keep striking out trying to get a new coach, a new general manager, a new team president. You saw the Padres just hired Bob Melvin away from the Athletics yesterday. And you have to, you know, Billy Beane and Theo Epstein both refused to come to the Mets. There was a lot of, you know, people thought that maybe either the president of the Brewers or the general manager of the Brewers might come over. Both of them were not given permission by Brewers ownership. So you have to wonder what's next for the New York Mets. And I want to turn your attention. Steve Cohen, who, look, he's got a lot of money. But money's not going to buy everything. And he keeps saying he doesn't want to pay somebody to learn on his dime. Which is fair. No owner should ever want to haphazardly spend his hard-earned money without knowing that he's going to get results. Yet, he seems to be learning on his own dime, too. He's making a lot of mistakes. There was a report the other day that he wants the governor of New Jersey to help look for, help him in a search for a team president. He's having his hedge fund company help try to find the new general manager. What is he doing? You need to rely on your baseball people. What does the governor of New Jersey, what do your hedge fund people know about what it takes to be a team president in Major League Baseball? What do they know about what it takes to be a general manager in baseball? What do they know about being a manager in baseball? I've got news for you. Get closer to your speakers. They know nothing about it. Okay? There is absolutely no reason for Steve Cohen to be leaning on these people to help him in his search. Look, Sandy Alderson has not exactly pushed the right buttons either. And I'm not saying that Cohen should be looking towards whatever Alderson's answers are. But at least Alderson has somewhat of a baseball background. He may as well call me up. Sure, I probably have more of a baseball background than the governor of New Jersey and his hedge fund people. It's ridiculous. And Mets fans keep... you have to feel for Mets fans. At what point are they going to get a competent owner and a competent leadership group? Every single year, it's, well, you know, there's excuses built in. My goodness. I don't even know what to say anymore. People don't know what to say anymore. If you're a Mets fan, there's no way that you can have faith in your organization whatsoever. Short of a miracle, short of Casey Stengel coming back from the grave, coming back from the great beyond, and putting the right people in place, there's nothing that the Mets are going to do right at this point unless there's a major, major turnaround. And I don't know that Steve Cohen's got the moxie to make that happen. Meanwhile, in terms of having the moxie to make things happen, the Yankees are in just a bad but they're in a bad situation too. Did you see the report the other day from Bob Clappish, who's one of the all-time best baseball columnists in the country, that somehow, without any clubhouse access this year due to COVID, he was still able to find out that the Yankees have a clubhouse issue, that Brett Gardner and Garrett Cole were going at it with each other, that the Yankees are walking on eggshells around each other. What does that say about what Aaron Boone was brought in to manage, to be that communicator, that great communicator? If your players are walking on eggshells, clearly you're not communicating well. It's that simple. And ladies and gentlemen, I wish I could go on and on and on about this, but unfortunately, my producers in my ear are yelling that we got to wrap up here. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for you here today. If you missed that live show, you can catch the recording on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, Spotify, Podomatic, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Player FM, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, and so much more. So please tune back in next Friday, November 5th at 4 p.m. for more Hot and Cold Takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner saying thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.